Hi, my name's Mary Carroll, Mary Carroll Day. I am 62 years old. I've just checked, and today's date is October the 4th, 2007. I'm here at the 50th annual meeting of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society in Baltimore, in a beautiful waterfront hotel. This waterfront is beautiful. I'm here talking with a very good friend and professional colleague whom I met, I think, in 1980.
It probably was right about that. Yeah.
Arnie Lund.
Yeah. And I'm Arnie Lund. I'm 57, just turned 57 not long ago. And, October 4th, 2007, here in Baltimore. And Mary Carroll and I have known each other a long time, so looking forward to chatting.
Yes. Well, Arnie, I see that you have a question on the top of your list here. And since we're here at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society meeting, and this interview was basically set up through the Society with StoryCorps, let me ask you how you got into the field of human factors.
Well, it's an interesting question because you can answer it in a couple of different ways. I think about it as sort of a converging set of influences on my life that got me started. I was just, earlier this week talking to a room full of students about how to grow their careers, and they were all trying to anxiously figure out how were they going to get into human factors and where was the field going to go. And I realized that back when I kind of started my career, at the very earliest stages, the field that we're in barely existed, if anybody even knew about it in those terms. So I kind of trace it back to college days. And in college days, I was a chemistry major at the University of Chicago. And so one influence was that love of science. I didn't know of many other sciences. I mean, there was chemistry and psychology and biology and so on. And chemistry was my chosen one at the time. But I was also, at the same time, you have to remember this was late 60s, time of protest and war and all those kinds of things. And I'm a person of strong faith. And so I had this, I was wrestling at the time and still continue to be of how can I make a difference in the world? What can I do to make the world a little bit better? And also at the same time, I was getting interested in psychology and philosophy. I was getting interested in the problem of why people make the decisions that they make. And that kind of twin or pairing of those three things of wanting to understand and wanting to make the world a better place and wanting to figure out how to apply that understanding to make that world a better place has kind of caused me to take all the different jobs that I've taken over the years that eventually got me into human factors.
Right.
Now, what about you? Well, how did you get into human factors?
Well, my route was fairly circuitous, too. I initially wanted to be a psychiatrist, actually, because I was very interested in the way the mind works. And my father, who was a fine old Southern gentleman, thought no young woman worth her salt would do anything other than be a nurse or a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up going to college in psychology, which I really loved. And then I went to graduate school in human development.
Mm.
I intentionally wanted a program that had a more applied orientation.
Right.
So I wound up getting a doctorate in education from the College of Education that had a more application-oriented program because I, like you, really wanted to understand more about people and science, but I also wanted to make certain it had some kind of an impact.
Yeah.
And like you, I wanted to make a difference.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of trite, but I really did.
So how did you get from there to Bell Labs?
Well, I was a faculty member at the University of Houston in developmental psychology. And I got very tired of being very poor, which as an academic I was.
Yeah.
And I also thought that, if I moved away from the University of Houston, I'd probably go to a small college town.
Yeah.
And I was single at the time.
Yeah.
And I thought, how many men would there be in a small college town? So when a friend called and asked if I wanted to interview at Bell Labs in Human Factors, I said, what's Human Factors?
Oh, that's interesting.
And I then went to the library and looked in the Human Factors Journal and saw what Human Factors was and said, you know, this is really cool. This is basically the application of experimental psychology methodologies to the design of products and services and environments that will help people. And I think I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, at that point, I didn't realize that there were a lot of other methodologies also in the human factors field that I would come to learn. So I wound up joining Bell Laboratories.
Oh, that's interesting.
So,
I mean, in that in-between stage, I went through some of those same kind of paths. I mean, when I got out of college, I came out with my chemistry degree, but then went off to seminary for a year and again was kind of continuing to be interested in why people make the decisions that they make, in this case moral and ethical decisions, spiritual decisions. And then that was when my wife Marlene and I had met and started courting and planning our wedding, and when we got married, that took me out of school and then down to California, and I started taking psychology classes, night school kinds of classes through Berkeley, and then eventually, while working as a jeweler, was taking classes from Cal State Fullerton and applied to their clinical program, because I was thinking of hitting in that same kind of path of trying to make a difference for people. There I had a mentor who I was serving as a teaching assistant for, and one of the early guys who made a difference in my life, and he came to me one day and he said, okay, I've taken your application out of the clinical program and I've put it in the experimental program because I think you're an experimental person. And
interesting.
I said, well, you know, why? And he said, well, yeah, and if you're in clinical, it's hard to get into experimental. But if you're in experimental, it's easy to get into clinical. I think he was speaking as an experimental psychologist, naturally, rather than clinical. But it was something I was enjoying doing, trying to figure out. At that time, I was studying, Kohlberg's theory of moral development.
I took a course from Kohlberg.
Oh, yeah. And those kinds of things. I thought, well, I could do, you know, this kind of experimental thing in this experiential place and maybe make a difference. And so I moved into experimental, and then from there I went on to my PhD. And also, as I was coming out of my PhD, was thinking of going into an academic life of teaching and research, and there weren't very many jobs at that time. And the one job I remember was in North Carolina in Cullowhee. And I remember what the pay was. And when I discovered that I could go into, there were industrial places I could go that paid three times with no teaching load, That was pretty attractive.
I can understand that because when I was in the psych department at the University of Houston, I really enjoyed the work that I was doing. And you know, my goal was to continue doing my research in developmental changes in attention and in formal operational thought. And then when I got tenure, do research on love.
Oh, interesting.
Not romantic love, but agape love.
Yeah.
Which I knew I could not do research on and get tenure.
Yeah.
But I too found out when I interviewed at Bell Labs, I had some criteria for, you know, how much money it would need to be to make me consider going, and then the amount above which I could not say no. And when the figure came in way above the amount for which I could not say no, I went to Bell Labs. But with, you know, with some concern, because I really enjoyed teaching.
I
really enjoyed the interaction with the young people.
Yeah.
At that point, it was especially kind of nice to be a female role model for a lot of young women who had not seen professional women, really.
So when did you start at the labs, at Bell Labs?
I started in 1980.
Okay, so right when I started, but probably earlier in the year, I'm thinking.
I probably started in around September.
Oh, okay, so it would have been almost exactly the same time.
Around the same time.
Yeah, okay.
And just like you, I joined Bell Labs at the time when it was starting to change from a really research-oriented place into more of a business institution. I thought I was going to a place that was midway between a university and kind of an application-oriented environment. But after I got there, it was very rapidly, at least a part of Bell Labs that both you and I were in, was very rapidly moving away from the emphasis on research per se to research that supported product design and development.
Yeah, I remember that when I was in graduate school, and the way I got there was Tom Landauer had come through.
And
very charming and looked like Mark Twain, and you know he was a character and he was smart, and we all had read work by him, and he was teaching classes in exchange for getting data as he went through the universities. And so I got picked to help him run this particular study demonstration he was doing with the introductory psych class. And then we went out for drinks afterwards in a local tavern and sat and talked. And he said, oh, yeah, he said, Bell Labs, it's a wonderful place. It's a place where you get paid for doing nothing practical. And if you, in fact, do something practical, you get into trouble. Well, it turned out the area of Bell Labs he was in, as you know, up in Murray Hill, was supposed to be very far out looking and not thinking in terms of near-term applied stuff.
Yes.
I didn't know that at the time. I just thought, oh, it must be this great research giant
that
utopia.
That was exactly my thought.
And then a few months later, friend of ours, Max, came through, who was in a different part of Bell Labs, and the pitch he made was, I remember saying that, oh, AT&T, it never changes. And he said, you get a job at AT&T, and it's like getting tenure. You just do your job and don't get into trouble, and you're there forever. And that was kind of, oh, and I could do this applied research and no teaching load unless I wanted to do something, and just think and be with other smart people, and it sounded pretty great. But yeah, I was there just a few months, and I started out, it was going to be in that area. I started out, they had hired me, and there was a lot of research, as you remember, on reading, and a lot of research on problem solving, but no research on reading to do problem solving. And so that was going to be my area. But within just a few months, it was, okay, we need you to look at Mary Carroll's research on LED colors, and we want you to figure out how voice and data signals start working. And we started to get into these applied problems very quickly. And actually, you know, it was kind of disappointing in a way, but it was also fascinating in another way to realize you were designing something that would be used by hundreds of millions of people.
So, that's right. I think that was one of the things that was really rewarding, especially after having been in basic research for a while, seeing your work really turned into a product. And I think, I was really fortunate because the first project that I worked on was a small communication system, Merlin, which made it out into the marketplace, which certainly not all products did, and which won some awards for user interface design. And even better, the first study I did at Bell Laboratories, which was on color deficiency, perception of bicolor LEDs, not only did I provide data that helped them make the decision not to go with the bicolor LEDs because of color deficiencies, but I met the guy who became my husband. So that was a very significant first experiment.
Now, what do you remember of those early days at the days we were there in Bell Labs, of what the community was like and what was going on within the community?
It really was a wonderful community, I think, from both a professional and a more general social perspective. There were a number of human factors people. So there was a large human factors community. And there were just a lot of bright people around. So if one needed help in absolutely any area, you could walk down the hall or maybe two halls and find an expert. And that was very special. It was later that I actually came to realize just how special that was. If you needed a piece of equipment, you could find it somewhere in that building. And then, of course, as I'm sure you remember, there were all of the clubs, from sailing to knitting to more technical things. And it was a very special time, even though it was changing very rapidly from that point. What do you remember most about those days?
Well, it was the same thing. I started in the department that had been John Carlin's department,
right.
You know, and so there was this long tradition. And it was much, in some ways, like being in graduate school in that there were a lot of smart people, a lot of people thinking about new ideas. You know, there was the very early work on cell phone things, and we were connected up with the video tech stuff, and video conferencing and speech recognition were being worked on, and they were all new. And, you know, I was excited being, you know, having some of that techie side to me that I grew up with and always was wanted to be in. You know, to go downstairs and program and get onto the ARPANET and realize it connect with anybody in the world, and then have these people, you know, up in Murray Hill and other places doing these innovating, exciting things, and then seeing all these new products emerge, it felt like you were in the middle of something emerging and new. And there was this support for, you know, very early on, there was this support for thinking broadly and thinking deeply. You were aiming at products, but unlike in the years since, particularly I think as the industry is involved and many of us who've kind of moved into some of the software companies, there wasn't as much bottom line focus. There was still, I felt, you know, that goal of, I think of it as a derivative of the universal service charter that they had, of do the right thing, you know, figure
yes.
out what the right thing is and do the right thing. And that was exciting and fun. And it was a chance to then see this larger community kind of across Bell Labs. I mean, can't remember how many we had, but it was like hundreds of behavioral science people. And so we were a small society in ourselves with our internal conferences.
Right.
And, you know, eventually, you know, we had a couple of special issues of the journal we worked on, you and I worked on together, and the internal conference and stuff. And that was all fun. And it was sort of through that then that I became aware of the larger world, like the Human Factors Society and SIGCHI and some of the other things that we belong
right. to. Well, you know, the Human Factors Society actually wound up being very important for me because I didn't go to graduate school in human factors at all, even though the methodologies were the same. You know, all the professors, the leaders in the field, the conferences I'd gone to, they were all different from those in human factors. As a matter of fact, here at this conference, you know, I've noted how many of our current leaders have referred back to their professors who were in the field of human factors. And I didn't have that. So right after I joined Bell Labs, I started looking around for a society that might be more appropriate than the developmental psych societies, and found the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society.
Yeah.
And I think I was fortunate in that the chair of my department at University of Houston, Ken Lockery, was very involved in HFES.
And
took the role of mentor, actually, introduced me to a number of people in the society, you know, made me feel welcome, kind of switching areas of specialization.
Yeah.
So the society has actually been very important to me in helping me move into a different area of application of behavioral science methodologies and in establishing a new network of experts and friends.
But you also stayed involved with APA over all those years, right? I mean, were you in the same areas, or did you move in that? And how did you juggle the two kind of professional connections?
Yeah, you know, actually, I recently joined APA again. Actually, it was when I left Bell Labs. I went to an APA meeting for the first time. That was in 1998 because I really felt the need to reconnect with my roots in psychology.
Yeah.
Unlike a number of people in our field, I think yourself included, I'm really not passionate about technology per se. I mean, I'm much more passionate about people, and I like human factors because I think I can help make decisions that will make technology appropriate for people like me,
who may
not be especially thrilled with technology per se. Now, you stayed involved, too, with APA, haven't you, and also with other organizations?
Not so much APA, more SIGCHI, I think. And it's more, well, APA is the American Psychological Association, and it had been sort of the parent professional association for a lot of academics, and for I was came out of cognitive psychology and verbal mm-hmm. learning, and they have an educational area and an applied area so as well. I kind of came through human factors, and in those early days, a lot of the Bell Labs folks had been active in starting up the communications technical group and bringing that Bell Labs community, which, as you say, had come from very diverse academic backgrounds, but not traditional human factors, I think, into human factors. And then when human factors helped get SIGCHI going.
Right.
And I remember the first big official SIGCHI conference down in Gaithersburg. And I was working for a person who's now a faculty member at the University of Michigan, who in her group, and we all gathered on the train in New Jersey and headed down to Gaithersburg together for that first big conference.
I remember I was there also.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Well, and that was when I kind of realized, now they were in a closer sweet spot to where my interests were. And my interests, you know, it's odd, again, if I go all the way back, even before college, to growing up, my mother was an artist, and my dad was an aspiring geek, sort of pre-geekdom. Mm-hmm. And he loved new technologies that were wireless devices and things like that. And he would buy all these things. And his tragic flaw was that he would start to tinker with them and break them down into pieces and never assemble them back up again. And so we had pieces of stuff all over our house. But that kind of the arts side and the people part and the technology part, that mix has always been interesting to me. And so that's where I like to, you know, I've sometimes gone more onto the developer and then back to, you know,
right.
psychology. But then I can't stay on the technology side because it's the people side that interests me. And so I kind of keep going back and forth.
And actually, that's one thing that I've always found fascinating about you as a friend and a professional colleague.
Yeah.
The fact that you're really, you know, extremely skilled and passionate about the technology, and I think can even think in a visionary way about technology. And yet it's clear you're really always rooted in the people,
yeah.
whether they're people you're managing or people who are friends of yours or people whose lives you're going to
yeah.
impact through your design. Now, tell me, how have you thought about the people in your life, in your jobs?
Well, it's like that. I mean, I it actually probably goes back to those shared almost clinical roots that I never got into and caring about people. So my groups over the years, and when I got into management, it was I haven't ever enjoyed management for management's sake. I mean, there are people who like to direct other people, who enjoy kind of the power part or the organizational part or that. I kind of like getting something done through a group that I'm influencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of guided me in the management roles that I've held and in the professional roles that I've held in the various organizations that I've worked on. And you know, it's caring about them and trying to help them be effective and also to kind of lay out a vision of what we're trying to do and take it to another level. It's sort of like your comment about love. I mean, right now even, I'm at Microsoft and I'm in an IT organization.
Mm-hmm.
And people usually think of an IT organization as pretty dry, as internal mm-hmm. systems and time cards and expenses and
mm-hmm.
like that. And we're
that's the way I would think of it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And we're expanding out to trying to support customers, ordering stuff mm-hmm. and getting support. But the kind of sensibility that's on the table is, instead of just thinking about that as another technology that somebody's going to do, let's think about relationship. Let's think about mm-hmm. how do you create a relationship mm-hmm. between people and a brand which represents potential and new things that can enable their lives to be better. And what does human relationships mean? And then how can you take that understanding of human relationships and represent that, in essence, in technology, or support it with technology, or make it richer with technology? And thinking about that and how you bring those two things together to make a new thing happen, that's kind of an emotional thing and an inside thing. That's, you know, that's the fun thing.
Yeah. And you know, personally, I'm very glad that there are people like you who are thinking about how to use technology to support the more significant, in my opinion, more kind of significant human values.
Now, how have you thought about these things over the years? Since you've been a long time with AT&T, and only not too recently, I don't think. Time has been passing quickly, but have left. So, but yeah.
About
kind of how you think about the people and the work that you and your teams have been doing. Well, I mean, what have been your goals? And
well, no, it's interesting. I think the most important thing to me when I was a manager was always the people in my group.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I ever really got out of the role of being the professor at a university.
Yeah.
I almost thought of my group members as very talented people whose careers I wanted to help further.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was always very fortunate, as I know you were, to work with people who were smart and kind and had good values and wanted to do a good job. And I just always found it thrilling to see them grow and develop.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a way, when I was at Bell Labs, that was actually probably more important to me than the work on the products and services themselves.
Yeah.
Now I have a little bit of a different situation working at Angel Medical Systems, where we're working on a device that we hope and think will detect heart attacks when they first start so that people can get help before there's any permanent heart damage or death. So really now, you know, it's very clear that I'm working on a product that can be extremely significant to people.
Yeah.
And I'm finding that very rewarding.
Now, while you were kind of working with your teams, you know, and kind of thinking back to when you left academia and were thinking about missing some of that teaching and so on, did all of the satisfaction you got in that role transfer into the management roles you've had, or have you continued to do teaching and working with students and things like that over the years? We haven't talked much about that.
So. No, we haven't. You know, actually, I have not continued to teach. I always found teaching to require a great deal of advanced preparation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it just took a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I found with things I was doing at Bell Labs, I just didn't have time to do that.
Yeah.
So it was really just through the people in my group.
Interesting.
And actually, one thing that I've missed most about being in a university setting, though, is being around all the young people.
Yeah,
just selfishly, because I think it helps keep you young.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what the current, you know, vocabulary should be and those sorts
exactly.
of things.
Yeah.
So how about you? I understand you have been teaching some recently.
Yeah, and that was, maybe it was, you know, it's like being weaned too early. You know, I'll continue to have that desire and and look for opportunities to teach and still kind of have that in my fantasy future. When I was at Ameritech and had my group there and we were growing, I had a class come in from Northwestern and talked to them for a while and started to get that bug back. And they said, well, how would you like to come as an adjunct faculty member? And I said, oh, yeah, I could do that. And so I did that for a while. And then coming out to Seattle, started to think about, you know, it would be great to do this again and talk to the University of Washington. I said, yeah, you could talk about user-centered design and in the evening. And you know, I got the support of my manager, and so I could leave a little bit early one day a week and do this late class. And I got to say, standing up there, you know, in front of a bunch of enthusiastic graduate students and kind of having the theory of our field laid out from the books and the articles, but be able to talk about all these years of experiences we'd have and say, you know, I illustrate this point with this project or this point with that project. It was a blast. I mean, it was like getting in the flow and, you know, the time would just sort of zoom away.
Do you plan to continue doing that?
I hope to. That, you know, it's sort of like the things that I dread in my life, mm-hmm. You know, I'm counting down the number of performance reviews I have to do.
I hated doing performance reviews.
I hate telling sharp people that I really like that they're not as good as other people I really like.
Yes.
I hate that part. And grading is kind of like that. I don't like that part.
That's true. There is a similarity.
You know, I like talking ideas. I like helping people understand. I like the problem-solving part. The kind of evaluation part's hard. But, you know, it's after all these years of doing all this stuff, it feels like it would be great to spend time to give some of it back. And there are all these, you know, still interesting problems of how people read to solve problems and, you know, how to make systems that create love and relationships and things like that, that we don't have good answers to. And I think part of what I've learned over the years is it would be fun to do research in those areas.
Right. Do you think you will do research in those areas in the future?
Well, I made a pitch a few months ago at Microsoft Research, and they have never done anything like that before, but the times, they're changing again, and maybe the times are right. I think it's very interesting to go from when we started and, you know, wireless was getting started and, you know, the precursor to the internet was getting started and all of these things that are now kind of reaching fruition. We're now kind of in this stage where people are understanding that social activity and communication and new forms of communication are so critical. And I think there's a greater sensitivity as it happens in this, you know, I think the web kind of made design more important and the aesthetic more important. Mm-hmm. And now as these things blend with this kind of consumer world we're in, where the devices can become expressive of who you are and how you fit in the world, there's, I think, a sense that these softer things that we were interested in back at the beginning mm-hmm. are relevant, and they need to be turned into engineering practice, and we don't know how to do it. And so I think that would be fun.
Yeah, I think that would be great, because those are the kinds of areas that it's really hard to get most companies, especially yeah. companies that are small and don't have deep pockets, yeah. to invest
yeah.
in. And, you know, if you can convince Microsoft
yeah.
that
yeah.
that is something to focus on, I think that would be wonderful. And you can hire me.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, I think one concrete example, which is one of my favorite memories over the years, mm-hmm. but I think sort of brings these things together. When I was at Ameritech at one point, we had started up a project talking with Children's Hospital in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a ward of children who were on medicines that completely suppressed their immune system. So they would be isolated in their rooms for weeks at a time
mm-hmm.
and couldn't get out. And so they were initially interested in just getting them some entertainment. And they said, okay, is there just some way you can get this, you know, computer technology into their rooms? And what we decided to do was to bring in network, basically audio conferencing or video conferencing or networked games, so that the children could interact with each other from their room, so they could, you know, play
yes,
together
yes.
without ever having to touch each other.
Great concept.
And I got to say, first of all, from an emotional perspective, when we've got the system completely installed and these big arms mm-hmm. so that kids could pull the things down to them, and the keyboards were protected with plastic so you could mm-hmm. clean them off, and we solved all those problems. We got software donated by a whole bunch of companies, got them all networked, and I got to come in and put on the Ameritech, you know, label donated by Ameritech
yes.
on there. And as I walked out of the room, there was this little boy being wheeled in who didn't have any hair any longer, was in chemo and was completely gone. He was just looking at the room, and I thought, his experience is going to be a better experience because of something I did. And he will never know, but I got to be part of that. It just, you know, made the hairs go up in my neck and my skin prickle. And then later
yeah.
we found that, in fact, that social interaction, that happiness, that joy, the emotional side of what he got helped him to heal, all those kids heal faster. So it had a medical impact okay. from the emotional side, supported by an emerging technology. That's kind of what we did.
That is a wonderful yeah. example. It is.
Yeah.
Has that kind of work continued? Do you know if they still have?
It's different. I don't know if they continued that work at that hospital. We were going to check back, and then, you know, that was when reorganizations of companies were being taken over, and I moved on to another set of companies. But it's, you know, it's a kind of thing that at each place I've been, and I think most of us, you know, we kind of keep looking for those things. I mean, I've always had a heart for accessibility and continue to try and help with accessibility or help with something else. Because I think it goes back to how we got into this. I mean, when you when you care for people, you continue to try and find ways to care for people, whether it's your job or not. So.
Well, in listening to you talk, it sounds as if you're happy you've had and are having a career in human factors.
Is that
fair to say?
I am. I mean, you know, when I talk to these students, you know, I talk about how a career in human factors is not like, has never been like a motorboat aiming for a particular goal. It's more like surfing because you sort of know generally what you want to do and you're in the moment doing it, but the forces that are shaping you are always evolving. It's people, society, and technology. And so there's always something new and there's new problems to solve. And yet, you know, you can kind of make a difference to it, and that's what's fun.
I agree with you. Yeah, I'm always impressed when I come to these meetings at the tremendous variety of problems that people are addressing. I think we were both at the President's Forum yesterday, and sitting there listening to the past presidents of HFES talk about the projects that they had worked on, you know, was just thrilling.
I think people don't know. Society doesn't know.
No.
We're there hidden.
Factors
inside trying to help.
That's right. There's a tremendous variety
exactly.
of ways people can have a positive impact.
Well, it's been great talking with you.
It's been great talking with you, too.